We hope and trust that you will find this Torah in Motion program meaningful. Through these programs, Torah in Motion encourages discussion, debate, and education about the most important issues facing Jews and Judaism today. Together, we can focus on creating religious commitment through an honest and sophisticated encounter with topics that are relevant to being Jewish in the modern world. For more information about this and other Torah in Motion programs, please visit the website at www.torahinmotion.org.
If I could have everybody's attention, please. Prior to Rosh Hashanah, you know, it's very common how rabbis, the community, go and prepare for the aspects of tshuva and repentance, the day of judgment. And I really think there's no more appropriate topic than the topic of our business dealings, our money dealings, to lead us into Rosh Hashanah. So I'm sure many of you are aware, the Talmud tells us that the first question after 120, when we meet our Maker, is nasata v'natata be'emuna, where our business dealings done in faith. It's not if we learn Torah or how firm we were. It's not of that. The first question God asked us is how were our business, how did we conduct our money affairs? And of course, it doesn't only mean that we conduct them in faith, but it means that we have faith in God when we conducted our business. The word emuna is normally a word we associate with our trust and faith in God. And since the Gemara tells us that how much money a person is going to make is decreed every year on Rosh Hashanah, one who tries to upset the decree by cheating, all kinds of pressure tactics, really shows he doesn't have faith in God. So one who cheats in business, not only cheating in business, but he displays a lack of emunah in the classical sense of faith in God. And I can really think of no greater, you know, speakers than the three speakers we have gathered here tonight. Dr. Meir Tamari, Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine, and Aaron Feuerstein, who I just found out was in Yeshiva College with my father back many years ago. I won't say how many, but it's a small world. And these three people, I think, epitomize that what the essence of being a Jew is: honesty, integrity. And it's a pleasure and it's really a privilege for me, and I think for our community, to have the opportunity to hear them here tonight. So I'll briefly go over the format of the evening. We will hear from all three of our speakers. We'll have a short 2-minute break in between each speaker. We will not take any questions till the end. So if you have any questions, make a note of them or jot them down. At the end of the presentations, we'll be here as long as you'd like, and their speakers are willing. We'll take a series of questions, and we'll make it into a panel a little bit. And of course, in addition, just to make the evening possible, you have a program which lists all the people who made it possible. We want to thank our sponsors. I want to thank Dr. Mark Schwartz, who helped to organize the program with us, really. And I want to thank Ilana for all her work in putting it all together. Our first speaker is Dr. Meir Tamari, who we've had the pleasure of having at our house over Shabbos. Dr. Tamari is a native of South Africa who 51 years ago made Aliyah to a kibbutz in Israel. A number of years later, went back to South Africa, where he's a Shaliach B'nai Akiva, and then went back to Israel and eventually worked in the office of the governor of the Bank of Israel, rising to the position of chief economist of the Bank of Israel. You have the information on the flyer. He's the author of a number of books, Sins in the Marketplace, In the Marketplace, The Challenge of Wealth, and his latest book, which is available here for sale. It just came off the printing presses. We are the first place in the world that has access to it. It was shipped by the publisher. It arrived on Friday afternoon at our house. So there are copies of his book. which is called, I was reading it a little bit over Shabbos, of Jewish Values in an Open Society, a weekly Torah commentary. It's a very interesting book. Like all his books, they're all worth reading. And without further ado, I introduce Dr. Meir Tamari.
Okay, firstly, shalom and thanks for coming. For me, every time I talk on the subject, it's like somebody who walks around as a grandfather with pictures of his grandchildren, and I sort of find myself doing this years and years and years, and I'm very pleased that you came to have a look at the pictures. I think at the outset, I would like to try and express some of the foundations, some of the concepts which lie behind the things I'm going to say. Firstly, we know that Jews lived under every economic and political system imaginable. And therefore, the source material which we have, whether it's halachic, or whether it's commentary on Chumash, whether it's Midrashim, have to take into account these circumstances and have to create a system which is applicable to every system. The second thing, in my opinion, we are talking about a value system. Just like kashrut is not a textbook in biology, even though poskim, etc., have to know about biology, but the laws of kashrut are not a textbook in biology. And the same thing is true of areas such as mikveh, fixing times for davening, etc., which require a knowledge of science. Nevertheless, they are not textbooks in science. They are spiritual, religious, moral, ethical systems. The same thing is true with economics. It's true that our rabbis understood economics. It's true that our rabbis knew how the system works, because otherwise you can't handle it. But Judaism, as I said, is primarily an ethical, moral, spiritual system, and therefore any economic activity, any business decision, whether at the level of the individual firm or of society, needs to be scrutinized within that system. I dislike very much, even though we use it, the word business ethics. Ethics is a Greek concept. I would prefer to use a very basic term, asur v'mutar. This is permitted and this is forbidden. This is kasher, meaning fit, and this is not kasher. And like there is kasher food, food that is fit to be eaten, so there is kosher money. Thirdly, it is true that our sources understood the workings of the market and understood that there are efficient markets and that efficient markets are good for people. But efficiency isn't a Torah end in itself. And just like with every other need of people, whether it's food, sex, clothing, political organization, Torah came to put it into parameters, to put it into certain forms, so too, yeah. And just like you might be frustrated by the sexual laws in Torah, So you might be frustrated by the limits that we put on the efficient market. Maybe. Nevertheless, this is what it's about. Fourthly, there is no such thing as an anti-commercial bias in Judaism. There are religions like that, primarily Christianity. There are religions which saw the making of money as illegitimate. At the best, a condescension by the Creator. You know the story of the money lenders, the question of how a rich man goes into heaven, has to become transformed into a camel and go through a needle, etc., etc. Profit, Marx's theory of value, that the only people who contribute to the value of something are the workers. There is a very similar Catholic theory in the Middle Ages. No such Jewish theory. A person is entitled to make a profit from what he does. Otherwise, he wouldn't do it. A person goes to work and he's entitled to get paid for it. A person makes an investment and he's entitled to make a profit on it. Otherwise, he wouldn't do it. Having said that, there is a way that it may be done and there is a way that it may not be done. Since I might not have another chance, very briefly, these limitations are very simple. A person is obligated to learn Torah, and this is a never-ending limitation because rich, poor, old, sick, young, clever, stupid are obligated to learn, and this means time taken away from making money. So that in addition to the Chagim, Shabbat, etc., etc., the festivals, this is a limitation. And there is Tamari theory of enough. I would like to suggest that there is such a thing. I don't know how to define it. I'm not talking poverty. There is such a thing in Judaism that a person needs to know that there is enough. Not just a person. A society needs to know that there is enough. And I would suggest that if we don't know that, there's no morality. Not in sex, not in food, not in money. If there is never enough, or as the first pages of economics textbooks tell us, more is better than less, not Jewish. Sometimes less is better. Sometimes it's necessary to say die, to say enough. Wealth comes from a Kodesh Baruch Hu. So we're talking about commerce. You're allowed to do commerce? Yes, otherwise that's the way God made the world. God made the world in such a way that if you want to eat, if you want to wear clothes, if you want to have a house, you've got to do it. For 40 years, God fed us from heaven. And after that, the world required normal economic activity. Why did it that way? I don't know. But he provides for us today. You know, we say there's a prayer, Ashrei Yoshev Etecha. In Ashrei, there is one verse which if a person didn't say that with conviction or attention, he didn't pray. And that is that you open your hand and you feed all the world. So the food comes from heaven anyhow. Accepting that it doesn't come by miracles, but it comes in a natural way. And if the wealth comes from God, so God is a partner. Probably the worst human invention that we could ever invent was to make God a business partner. Because he has a say how the money can be made. This way, yes, and this way, not. Now, Judaism's about having God in the bedroom, and in the dining room, in the kitchen. Maybe that we can live with, but it's having God in our business. This is a big problem. And this means what you do with the money. The partner demands not only that the money be made properly, not only are you allowed to buy and sell, not only allowed to produce, not only are you allowed to create things, you're obligated, otherwise you're not going to eat, but There's a certain way, and what you do with it is important. So I would like to suggest that if we look at all this economic activity, knowing that all wealth comes from God, knowing that there are permitted and forbidden actions, and knowing that there is such a thing as enough, then I think we can see the picture a little bit more clearly. It's not my choice. They told me they're restricting me to a few subjects. Otherwise, we can sit here, I can sit here all day, or week, or month, or year. So unfortunately, I'll have to narrow it down to one or two areas. There is a problem that people who in their personal lives are perfectly moral, when they do business, especially in the corporate form, then there becomes a separation of identity. I don't pollute. I don't cheat. I don't use child labor. I don't exploit. The corporation doesn't. We know, we learned it at school. Corporation is a separate legal entity. But what happened was it became a separate moral entity. Does this have a place in Judaism? So from a legal point of view, the corporation as a limited liability entity. In other words, that if I can't pay my debts, the creditors can't touch my personal assets. There are enough responsa which would show that this is halakhically in order. This is in Jewish law order because there was a contract of money. Everybody knows that the limited liability corporation means you can't attach my assets, and therefore this is the basis on which we did our business, and there is a place for this concept. I'm not sure that there is a place for a limited ethical personality. And therefore, business activity conducted either by the individual or as a corporation, where the shareholders are Jewish, will have to operate in the same way. You can't use the corporate veil to hide behind and to do things which Tzoka said you're not allowed to do. The authorities would say that maybe with interest you can use the corporate form in order to evade it. Most authorities say you can't. But there are many other issues. A corporation which works on Shabbat, owned by Jews, they sit in shul and the corporation works on Shabbat, it's a different person. Not acceptable. A corporation which pollutes, which steals, etc., 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 the things which Torah said you're not allowed to do, you can't use a corporate form. What happens to the CEO of a non-Jewish, we don't know what it is, the CEO of a quoted, a listed corporation? We have no idea of who the shareholders are, but he controls it and he is Jewish. Since there are Noahide laws, which are obligatory on the non-Jew, I would like to suggest that he can't run the corporation, even though it doesn't belong to him, in a way which will permit the Noahides who own it from doing things which Torah said they're not allowed to do. So it has to do with corporations which do damage, which lead to loss of life, etc., etc. As a result of meeting Mark Schwartz, I saw some of the business ethics textbooks being used. You know, I'm in business for myself. I don't care what the other guys write in their textbooks, just like they probably don't read my stuff. But I thought, maybe I'll look at the textbooks and I'll see what they're talking about. Many of them have an introductory chapter which uses the parable of the sadhu. Sadhu, Indian holy man, a gentleman who was a CEO of a major corporation, every year went mountain climbing in the Himalayas. In his vacation, and one year they went climbing, there's a race, Japanese, French, German, etc., groups, and Nebuch, on the way up, they find a dying sadhu, a dying Indian holy man. You've got a problem. What do? Do you let the man die and continue your race, or do you save him and you lose the race? And it dawned on him that this is what happens in his business every day. He has to make decisions which make or do conflict with his personal morality, but never saw it so starkly. He has a problem. So somebody suggested that there is a free market solution to it. We'll pay somebody, one of the teams, to give up the race, and they'll save the guy. The guy will be happy, they'll be happy, and I'll be happy because I'll climb the Himalayas. I don't believe that there is a monotheistic faith, Islam, Christianity, or Judaism, which could accept that. Because climbing the Himalayas and running a corporation are limited. And therefore, it's not unlimited, not everything is permissible, and the race isn't the only thing. Now, there is a market, we're engaged in the market, we compete in the market, and this competition takes many, many different forms. And we all know that it's good. Cheaper products, better products, new products, all these things are good for us. Is there a problem? It usually helps, although we don't do it always, it usually helps in these kind of discussions to be able to define what is the problem. The problem here is, firstly, that as a result of this competition, somebody might lose his job, or somebody might lose his business, or a whole society. You move your factory to Mexico, and it's true, it's efficient, and the town which made furniture, etc., doesn't have any work. So society has to balance. It took me many years to discover, I'm going to say now, that's what Judaism is about a balance, economic efficiency and morality, making a living and being pious. Same thing here, we have to balance the benefits which we receive from the competition against the loss, if there is a loss. I had the great fortune, my first year at university in South Africa, to have a teacher who was one of the pillars of an economic school which is to the right of Milton Friedman. Can you imagine these such a thing? And this gentleman, Professor Hutt, explained to us there's no problem. Why? Because the efficient market solves the problem. In time, I'm going to use the jargon deliberately, the factors of production, capital and labor, move in such a way that new firms are set up, new jobs appear. I was 18 years old. I was never a very reserved or timid person. And I said, tell me, how long does this take? He says to me, there's a short run and is the long run. I said, how long is the long run? Worked out the long run can be 100 years. Oh, you know what? I didn't know who I was quoting because I never read it. But Samuelson said, in the long run, we're all dead. I became a Trotskyite because of that class. So we have a problem. We have to balance it. Let's take a few examples. I'm running a business, I'm running a firm, and I've got workers, and they're all good workers. And the market changes. We live in a period of high tech. One of the big differences, perhaps the major difference, between the new economy and the old economy is the element of time. Once upon a time, it took 200 years for something to become obsolescent. Today, a person has a software program today, next week it's out of date. And therefore, the time period of employment, the time period of changing, the time period of investing, all became much shorter. But the same principle applies whether we're talking about the old economy and about a factory or about the new economy. I want to close the business down, it doesn't pay. Or we discovered in the 1980s, in the 1990s, that welfare costs money. And if you give women maternity leave, as in many countries except the United States of America, etc., or pension, or sick leave, costs money. Machines don't go on vacation, they don't have children, they don't get old. And if they do get old, you can throw them out. So now we want to cut workers. We've got a good product, we're making money, everything's all right, but we discovered we can put machines instead of people. Or we can shift it to a different country. So, are we allowed to lay off workers? Yes. Because I never made a contract with them that they're going to work for me forever. And they never made a contract that they're going to work forever. Once had a session in San Francisco, and the gentlemen, all wealthy guys, were complaining about how their workers leave them in the lurch and go and find a different job. I said, what happens when you want to fire them? That's a different story. So it works both ways. The worker is free to leave when he likes, and the employee is free to fire him. We're not talking about whether there's a contract. If there's a contract, you're not allowed to do it. But where there's no contract or where there's no local custom, then he can go when he likes and I can go where I like. There is a religious, spiritual problem, by the way, involved in this. One of the reasons why people want job security, why people want to stay in the same place, is because uncertainty. I don't know what's going to be in the future. And one time there was this vaunted Japanese system of where you sold your lifelong work to Toyota or to Sony in exchange for lifelong employment. And we Jews said, no, people are free people, they're free to go. Freedom is very important. So now I lay them off. But now they're poor. Now they're unemployed. And maybe Professor Hart's model is going to take 100 years. What are they supposed to do now? Is it my problem? I would like to suggest that it is and it isn't. I would like to suggest that depending on the size of the downsizing, you know, we invent nice words, it's much nicer to talk about a downsizing than to talk about redundancy or about about unemployment. So let's say I got 500 workers and I'm going to lay off 10 of them. I think we would be able to demand that in the interest of charity, you can keep them. Nobody will go bankrupt. Nobody will, no corporation will disintegrate if it keeps 10 extra workers. But there is a limit in Judaism on charity. Man's not supposed to throw away all his money on charity and then become poor. There are religions like that, you know. If you remember Francis of Assisi, all sorts of other people who gave away all their money and they became poor. We couldn't understand what's the difference. What's the seichel? What's the intelligence in having a poor Shimon and transferring that to a poor Reuven? We still got a poor guy. So beyond a reasonable situation, you would be able to leave them. But now I've got a bigger problem. What are these people supposed to do? And let's remember, it's not just a question of earning a living. A terrible thing to say to somebody, you're redundant. Society doesn't need you. Or to have young people, as you have in England and in Europe, who have never worked and may never work. Now they got what to eat. I'm useless. A man comes home and tells his family, I'm useless. Children, a wife, etc. So it's not just a question of earning a living. I think the total system, we would force society to take on that responsibility. I just said two dirty words. One of them is to force, and the other one is society. Because we live in a time when, even in Judaism, people walk around talking about a non-coercive Judaism. I don't know what that means. I see that in Judaism, society, but they didn't, courts, God has the power and the obligation to force. And the community in Judaism is a real person. The community has obligations and therefore it has rights. If a community has an obligation to look after the poor, the sick, the old, the redundant, and even the lazy, because lazy people aren't allowed to die of hunger either. If it has that obligation, it has the right to take money in the form of tax and to use it for this purpose. We come back to that when we're supposed to talk about compassion. I'm not sure what that is, but we'll see in a moment maybe. And therefore society has an obligation to do this. The individual has an obligation. I would like to suggest that this corporation, which just got rid of its workers, might not have an obligation to give them money, but as an act of charity, and the emphasis is on the word charity, it should provide training, job information, which the worker might not have. Because Maimonides writes, the Rambam writes in his Order of Charity, that the highest form of charity is to lend interest-free money, not to buy groceries, but to start a business, or to give a person a job, or to make him a partner. And if you can't do that, at least to give him advice. So if there's any meaning in that, a Jewish corporation would be obligated to help its workers find jobs, to lend them money. By the way, this is not so far-fetched. Margaret Thatcher did this in England and broke a major unemployment problem. She encouraged private enterprise to guide, to train, to fund the establishment of small firms. Philanthropy, private charity. We'll come back to that private charity in a moment. We have a halakha that a person who was rich and became poor So he's entitled to get his standard of living back again. And if he was used to riding on a horse and having somebody to go in front of him as an act of honor, he's entitled to that. I would suggest that the unemployed worker is entitled, that society should give him that psychological help, etc. There was a Hasidic admor, a Hasidic teacher, Simcha Bunim of Pshischa, and he said, you know, I can understand this thing about the horse. Person gets tired. You've got to give him a horse. He should be able to ride on a horse. He says, I don't understand what's this business of the guy going in front of him. He says, it's a narishkeit. It's a stupid thing. He says, yeah, the stupidity he's also entitled to. The psychological help he's also entitled to. For about 20 years, in the Western world, we had overshooting of this idea. It was an idea of full employment. The full employment, if it becomes government policy, is only needed because at the market price, or the real market price of labor, nobody would employ these people. And therefore, we will either create a false price through subsidy or to give government assistance so that people should provide work, etc. And then we discovered an interesting thing. It's a very good thing. People should have work. Israeli economy was a showcase for this, but the same thing applied to all the socialist economies. We had practically no unemployment. Everybody had a job. But it's interesting. There are two languages in the world which have two different words for working and going to work. One of them is Russian, and the other one is modern Ivrit. Because when I went to work, I went to place of work. I didn't go to work. There was full employment. The government looked after it. I went to work every day. We went to work. And separate from that, we went to the place of work. I'm going to work. I'm going to the place of work. Two separate words. We had a guy in the Bank of Israel. Worked about 15 years, never did a day's work in the place. And they shifted him every time from one place to another. The works committee wouldn't allow them to be fired because if they can fire him, they can fire me. And one day I heard they were going to lay him off. I said, you're not allowed to do it. So what do you mean? The guy doesn't work. I said, he's now in his late 40s. He has 4 children. You didn't have the courage to lay him off the first day. Now keep him. What will we do? Send him to me. Okay, so what's their work? You know, I said, he won't work by me. This is charity. There's 1,200 workers in the Bank of Israel. Some work, some don't work, some work half-time, etc. There'll be another one. I took the guy, said, you should know one thing. Don't touch my data. This is not work. This is charity. It's a soup kitchen. Every day, a month, we'll give you your salary. It's chas v'chalila, God forbid you should touch the data. Gave him a job. 6 months later, I gave him a rise. He said, what did he works well? I said, no. I said, you just gave 80% of the workers in the Bank of Israel a raise. You didn't give some a raise and some not. Everybody got a raise. That's charity. Charity is also entitled to. The only problem was that the guy thought that he wasn't getting charity, and one day he touched the data, and then I had to get rid of him. So this is the other side. Of course we've got to look after you. But it's a problem. So there has to be a balance between my obligation and his obligation. And the same thing applies to other forms of competition. At one time, I thought, like other people, that the whole question of the ethical side of competition was its economic side. The question of I compete, somebody goes out of business, problem of better quality, better goods, etc. And then I came to an idea that maybe that's only a minor detail. Maybe there is another issue altogether. Maybe the real issue is whether I need to have it all. I don't know if it's an expression in this country, it's not a Jewish expression, whether I need to hog the market. Do I need to have full market share? Or maybe there's place for somebody else. Maybe it's necessary for me to limit my competition and to let somebody else have a place. Bad economics. But maybe that's what we're supposed to do. Because when I say, lend you money to open a business, you're going to compete with me. Because if I say I have enough, then maybe 10% of the market is enough. I don't need 20% of the market. But it's not just a question of economic efficiency. It's not just a question of economic morality. It's a question of being able to share. The Mishnah, which we learn in Pirkei Avot, in the Ethics of the Fathers, the people in Sdom were very evil, and all that they did was say, mine is mine and yours is yours. Not so bad. Private property. Work. I'll make an equal playing field. Everybody will be able to compete. Simple. And the rabbi said, you know what? He's only entitled to a passing grade. Midah benonit, it's an average. It's not 80%. Maybe it's 40%. We'll let you live. What were they doing in Sdom? What was so bad? All they were saying was, I'm not going to help you. The former chief rabbi, the late chief rabbi of the British Empire, once wrote a very important article on the inner cities. You have a problem in all the bigger cities. Rich people move out, poor people move in. There's unemployment, etc. And he said, you know, all these immigrants from Jamaica and West Africa and Pakistan, they should do what the Jews did. The Jews immigrated, they were poor in Whitechapel, and they pulled themselves up by their bootstraps. And that's what they should do. They didn't ask for handouts. Utmost admiration I had for the Lord Jacobowitz, always. One of the few outspoken Jewish leaders for morality in all forms. And I said, you know, the Moshal and the Nimshal are not the same. The parable and the mini are not the same. Because my father and the Lord Jacobowitz and all the other Jews came from families which were literate. They came from families which could read and write, if not English, another language. They came from families which appreciated the understanding of the importance of learning, of going to school. There was a father and a mother. The lady who came from Jamaica has three children. She doesn't have a husband. She never went to school. Her mother never went to school. She doesn't think it's important to go to school. She doesn't have shoes. How is she supposed to pull herself up by her bootstraps? But not only that. She doesn't have a community. Because my parents came to South Africa, and Jews came to Canada, and they came to the States, and you couldn't borrow money in a bank. A little bit anti-Semitism forbidden because it was a bad credit risk. But you could borrow money interest-free from the community. And the community paid for us to go to school. And there were Jewish free schools all over. And Hebrew schools, etc. Why is this lady to blame? Because in Jamaica there's no community. And therefore, what was possible by the Jews isn't possible yet. The community is real. We talk about philanthropy. We have a concept of community which is not Jewish, which is Christian. Being community means belonging to the mosque or the church or the synagogue. Jewish communities were people, were real entities with the right, two very important rights of taxation and a private legal system. Very much part of statehood. We raised our own taxes, we funded our own communities, and we had the ability in most European countries to enforce our own laws. And therefore there is Jewish philanthropy, charity, we give charity, very important. But there is also coerced charity. There is tax money which goes to pay for the needs of society. The free market revolution, rebellion, whichever way you want to look about it, of Reagan and Thatcher and Kohl, said, you know what, instead of the state doing it, private individuals should do it. Very good. We like that. There's always been stock in Judaism. But what happens if the private individuals don't want to do it? What happens if they're stingy? Most people are stingy. You know, there's a pshiska idea that we don't say a bracha, we don't say a blessing when we give charity. All other mitzvot have a bracha. You thank God for telling you to do it. This is a commandment which God, why don't you say a bracha? So Simcha Bunim said two reasons. One of them, he said, you know, before we say a blessing, so we prepare ourselves, we learn about it, we think about it. Hasidic world, we go to the mikveh first. There's big preparation. He says, you know, by the time we'll be finished preparing ourselves, the guy will die. Give him the charity without a bracha. A second reason, he says, a mitzvah has to be done in happiness. He says, you know what, I never saw anybody happy in giving away money. So that's why there's no bracha for it. What happens if Judaism is a real religion? We give charity, but sometimes we don't want to give charity. I don't like you. I think you're a fake. Why should I give you my money? 101 reasons. You don't want to give charity? We'll make you give charity. Twice the Torah says. The Torah says you're not allowed to close your hand. And then the Torah says you have to open your hand. So Yitzchak Tversky of Boston wrote a very nice article. He says, one is philanthropy. You give out of the kindness of your heart. And the other one will force you. Tax. First time Milton Friedman came to Israel, he said, shouldn't be an income tax law in Israel. Jews have been better tax evaders than they've been tax collectors. So I said to him, you know, maybe you got a Nobel Prize for economics. For Judaism, you don't get a Nobel Prize. We always had a tax system. There is a vast literature of response dealing with taxes. Because society has needs, obligations, and we will fund it. And that's important because of the idea of compassion. Important to have compassion. You should be sorry for me. You should help me. But what happens if you don't want to? In the first book I wrote, I kept on writing about charity. So the copy editor used to scratch it out, send it back to me, and write tzedakah. And he says, you know, charity has negative overtones. It's not good, people are ashamed. It's not good in Judaism, it's an obligation. You should write tzedakah. And I used to scratch out his tzedakah and write charity. This went on for a long time. Finally, I said, you know what? It's my book. You want to write? You write your own book. In my book, I'm going to write charity. Why? Because charity has a negative overtone. That's right. This is the protection which society has against exploitation. Otherwise, you find people living off welfare. You find people saying that I'm entitled to it. The Western countries of Western Europe have a major problem today because they can't cut pension plans, they can't cut welfare. So that's why it's necessary to talk about charity. You're getting something for nothing. We have full employment. We're giving you unemployment insurance. We're giving you free education. We're providing health. We're giving it for you nothing. Supposed to give charity without it. I said, yes, but you don't understand that when we use tax money for the needs of society, we're taking money away from somebody else against his will. When I give charity, I do it on my own bet. I do it thinking willingly. But my taxes I don't pay. You forced me to pay these taxes. Therefore, morally, if you can force me to take my to pay my money, you have a moral obligation to see that the money isn't wasted. It's not the same thing as giving private charity, secret, without a means test, without looking after anybody. That's one thing. That's your charity. You're giving it willingly. But tax money? I don't want to give women any money. I don't want to give money to unmarried mothers. I don't want to give money to drug addicts. I don't want to give money to lazy people. My charity I won't give. But you tax me for it. You force me to give. Then we have the right to protect ourselves. That there shouldn't be a welfare mentality. That people shouldn't be prepared to live from it. So the rabbi said a person should always flay a horse in public rather than take charity. But the same word, tzedakah, has a root called tzedek. And that's the other side of the coin. That's the other side of the equation. We're not only talking about philanthropy, we're talking about having a just system. A Noahide, and a Jew definitely, a Noahide has an obligation to have just laws. And a Noahide is forbidden to steal. So there's a discussion between Maimonides and Nachmanides, between the Rambam and the Ramban. And Maimonides says that this is we learn all the moral laws of business from the fact that they have to have just laws. And this idea of having a just economic system is, I think, the second part of the equation.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll take about a 3.5 minute break. You want to stress there are refreshments outside, but we want to, you know, keep the program moving. Afterwards, we'll have the questions. So if we can be back here at about 22 minutes to 9.
I'm the one who talks next.
Yeah, you're next.